You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Mike Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Theodore Roszak. He's the author, most recently, of a novel, The Memoirs of Elizabeth Frankenstein, from Random House. Recently as well, the University of California Press have reissued his classic study, The Making of a Counterculture, and his recent book, The Cult of Information, and those books will, I think, enter into our conversation as we go along. Now, in The Memoirs of Elizabeth Frankenstein, which is a novel narrated by the wife of Victor Frankenstein, alchemy provides the counterpoint to what in Mary Shelley's novel had been electricity. And I'm wondering what led you to an interest in the alchemical marriage.
The alchemy is actually in the original book. I think it's one of my more scholarly discoveries that I found it there. I was struck when I first read the book, and I read it originally in close company with Carl Jung's research on alchemy. The number of clearly alchemical references in the book, the references throughout to Elizabeth, who is the fiancée of Frankenstein. She's actually his wife for only about a few hours at the end of the book. It's a fatal marriage. She spends the rest of the book as his fiancée. She's always referred to as the Golden Girl. Why the Golden Girl? She's always surrounded by a celestial light. She has angelic qualities. And then finally she's referred to as his more than sister. Well, all of this is a clear tip-off that there's an alchemical subtext running through the book. And indeed, Victor, the mad doctor, starts his career in the book as an alchemist. He reads all the alchemical authors and then is talked out of that by his professors at the university, who call it the old and exploded system. Clearly what Mary Shelley was getting at was that the relationship with Elizabeth, which is not only a love relationship, very few people think of this as a love story, but it's a love relationship, and it also masks an alchemical symbol of unity, masculine, feminine unity, that Mary Shelley intended to be there. And I think the moral of the story is that the further Victor Frankenstein gets away from an alchemical sensibility, the crazier, the more destructive he becomes. And that's the beginning of making monsters out of nature.
Now, as I read your work, I would suspect that Victor Frankenstein has no choice but to be a mad scientist, or at least it seems to me that there are nothing but mad scientists.
That's a pretty strong statement. I mean, I've met a few whom I think have a lot of soul and a lot of sanity. But you're right about one thing. I would agree with you that everyone who wants to be a successful scientist, and up until very recent years we'd have to say he, these would all be men, have had to adopt a certain stance in the world. It's had to be what we call objective, stand off from, scrutinize without feeling, with as little feeling, with as little subjectivity as possible. And above all, to prove that what you know about the world or have discovered about the world is the source of some kind of power. Well, if you put that all together, it's not the way we would want to treat other human beings, right? To scrutinize them coldly, to see how we can manipulate them to gain power over them. That's exactly the kind of relationship that has been built up traditionally between men and women in our society in marriage situations, sort of thing that's becoming the basis for marriages coming apart in our own time. To have that as our official prescribed relationship with the whole of the natural world, this kind of compulsively masculine need to dominate, that's crazy. And in that sense, I would agree that there is a crazy streak running through the whole of science. The achievement of Mary Shelley was, I feel, to embody that fact, which she early on recognized it in her own lover, Percy Shelley. She embodied it in a great story, and that's what it makes it more than just a story. It's got this mythical quality of telling a deep truth about our whole relationship with the universe.
So what becomes in this novel the memoirs of Elizabeth Frankenstein of the alchemical union is in a way another marriage of you, Theodore Roszak, and Mary Shelley. What makes it a marriage or a union rather than a struggle for domination?
That's actually a very insightful observation. I mean, I have been living with this book, I would say, for over 20 years. I knew from the time I first read Mary Shelley's Frankenstein that I would do something with this story. The question was what? I wanted to retell it in a way that would deepen it. So I've been living with this book and this woman for a very long period of time, and it is like a strange marriage, a marriage of minds. It's an intellectual love affair I've been having with a woman who instantly has a very real presence in my imagination. I see her always as this slight, brilliant, beautiful, daring, even recklessly daring, bohemian young woman at the age of 19 when she ran off with Shelley. She actually knew him from 14, 15 on, but she was a teenager, in effect, but a very brilliant and daring adolescent. And she's been with me all these years in exactly that form. She never grows any older. I guess she's a sort of image of my perfect woman. And it is kind of high-handed to say you want to give her a voice, because she had a voice of her own, after all. I'm just fascinated with the story, and in a sense, I want to get in on it. It's been with me since my childhood, at least in the form of the motion pictures, and has haunted me. So at some point, I wanted to tag on to this story. You know, with myths, that's permissible. Myths have to be told over and over again. So I'm not sure I've improved on her story. I wouldn't say that. I'd say I've commented upon it in a way that gives it some new angles and some new depths, I hope.
Well, I guess what I wanted to suggest was that there's a procession in this book of male figures. In this procession of male perceptions of the universe, the final one is yours. You as the author come in and say that a novel from the past contains in it elements that are trace elements, say, that can be heightened and brought to fullness, and that what makes you sure that you are not another of the male imposers?
What can I say in my defense, having taken over a woman's book and tried to rewrite it in this way? First of all, I do present Elizabeth Frankenstein in the book, who incidentally is very close to Mary Shelley as a personality, as inhabiting a male world, because that was the world of the 18th century. We're only at the very beginning of a women's movement. Mary Shelley's mother was one of the first feminist voices. So we're in a world that is still very patriarchal, very masculine-dominated. And so Elizabeth's experience is that of a patriarchal world. However, within it, she does find this remarkable stepmother, Lady Caroline Frankenstein, who is actually a composite of a lot of liberated ladies of that period, Madame de Stael and George Sand and Mary Wollstonecraft herself. So she finds her way to women who are strong and independent and free-thinking. But by and large, she is surrounded by very paternal masculine figures. So in adding my own voice to that procession, I had to be somewhat humble in doing that. And the way I found to be humble was to make sure that I didn't try to do this on my own. I needed a lot of help. This is a book of a man telling a growing up story of a young woman. And I asked women to help me, starting with my wife and my daughter, who are very strong feminists. The book was read by easily a dozen women before it was read by a single man. And I took seriously everything they told me. And the most interesting lesson I learned early on was that when a couple of the women told me, you know, you're bending over backwards to make all the women in the story virtuous and all the men in the story obnoxious. And that's a typical kind of mistake for a male writer to make in telling a story like this. And the way they put it to me was, you know, you're making every every encounter in the book between men and women a clash, a confrontation, as if they always have to be the opposites of one another. I took that to heart and I rewrote whole sections of the book. I reconstructed Victor's character in the book to make sure that Victor had depths that were not there, emotional depths, sense of intuition, a certain amount of romance. As a matter of fact, I had to reconstruct some of the males in the book more than the females in the book, though I finally gave Lady Caroline Frankenstein a ruthlessness that had not been there to begin with, that I wanted to hold back on. But I finally made her a pretty ruthless woman. So I wound up learning a lesson, and the lesson was, rather than thinking of every encounter between male and female in this story, or maybe in life as a whole, as a confrontation of opposites, you know, the phrase, the opposite sex, suggests that always, to think of these genders as adjacent, as neighboring. That helped me, that image, that I was looking at things in life from two different angles, the way our eyes see things from different angles. Our eyes are adjacent. And I tried always to remember that I was viewing things in life from these two very different angles, and that if you can at least try to hold those angles, those two perspectives, and maybe many more than that, because gender is not the only thing that gives us perspective in life, you're probably going to avoid some of the worst mistakes. We don't choose between our left eye and our right eye when we're looking at things. Try to get them both into focus. Now, the problem in the book then became clear to me. It was Victor's incapacity to see with both eyes, to see with from both gender directions. The feeling he had as a brilliant young scientist growing up in the world, that he had to root out the femininity in him, that he had to leave that behind to become a great scientist. And I think that's what Mary Shelley was saying in the book. After all, she told the story originally as a love story, a man and woman who are destined to be married, and they don't get married, and they don't get married, and they don't get married until it's too late. And when they finally do get married, it results in the bride's death. So the book ends with the death of the feminine. Her book ends that way. My book ends that way because I think the history of science dictates that as the problem. As long as we insist on seeing the world of nature through one eye, we will have what William Blake called single vision. So I see Mary Shelley's text as still another commentary on Blake's great criticism that scientists don't see things wrong, they just see them too narrowly.
And speaking to Theodore Roszak, the author most recently of the memoirs of Elizabeth Frankenstein, at the end of the book, Elizabeth meets the monster, a kind of pathetic creature. Reminds me of one of Wordsworth's wanderers. He's like the leech gatherer. Mm-hmm. He calls himself Adam, and they see in one another a certain twinship. They're both orphans. They've both been marred by the touch of forceps and scalpel. They see themselves then as what? Creatures, victims of a style of birthing.
Yeah, in both cases. I'm glad you noticed that.
I wondered, I guess what I'm responding to in part in this book is what seems to me to be an assumption. Somehow automatically, midwifery, witchcraft, alchemy are given virtues that we don't in fact know that they have. But as an author, you seem to speak with great confidence as if surely these are the completions or the solutions to the problems of science and of force.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think I'm saying that the alchemical vision of nature had certain depths and virtues in it that I would like to see retained. There are reasons why alchemy faded from the scene, and they were not entirely because it was up against modern science. It was also that alchemy had certain vices in it. It became overly elaborate, top-heavy with variations and improvisations that made it for people of by the 18th century intolerably complex and very obscure, almost deliberately so. I don't value that about alchemy, but I do value its capacity to see the world as a living presence and to take it seriously as a personality, to see personality in nature. It's one of the worldviews that allowed people to see that. So I try to mine it for that virtue. Midwifery was perhaps in the 18th century a better way of bringing children into the world than the new medicine was. The physicians who took over childbirthing in the 18th century, this is a major point in my story, were more apt to infect women and kill them off and to kill the baby than the old midwives were, simply because the midwives did not work from the paradigm that pregnancy and childbirth is a disease that needs to be handled by a professional physician. They saw it as an act of nature, and you facilitated it using the gravitational power of the earth.
Well, did you know, by the way, the figure about which our madman Dr. Celine's graduate dissertation was written? He wrote it about a doctor who discovered that it was important before they delivered a child that a doctor wash his hands. Mm-hmm. This, all the way into our century, was not known.
That's right.
That is to say that the intercession of the doctor itself brought infection.
That's right.
That the doctor had to be a clean and neutral agent. So, of course, it is astonishing what we don't know. But at the same time, I'm asking about the feeling that I have in these books. I reread The Making of a Counterculture with an enormous sense of nostalgic loss, because that was a time, the 1960s, that I had an enormous affection for, came to consciousness in, and you reminded me of one of the founding ideas of the 1960s, which is that the people leading the government were mad. The other thing that I continually remember, you know, when trying to explain to people how the excitement was able to spread so widely, was that when you said to someone, you have no choice, you must question received ideas. Something you've been told is so is only so if you experience it yourself. What I found myself thinking of, both in The Making of a Counterculture and in the memoirs of Elizabeth Frankenstein, is that there was the other side of madness, that during that period, in addition to the madmen who ran government, there was the worship of the madmen in the institutions, the kind of psychiatry that R.D. Lang practiced, almost as if the powerless and the failed were automatically to be valorized.
Yeah, a great mistake.
I think so, but I think there are trappings of that in this novel as well.
I will admit that possibility, because often you take on I tend to take on an adversarial tone in trying hard to make a point, and so you come down hard on one side. But when you step back and think about it, there's an old joke that I remember R.D. Lang telling me once in a conversation. He said, you know, They said that Galileo was crazy. They said that Edison was crazy. They said that Einstein was crazy. They said that Fred Murchison was crazy. And I said, "Well, Fred Murchison." He said, "Yes." He said, "He was my uncle. He really was crazy." So, in deciding what's sane and not sane, I don't think the limits of an institution, any institution, will be enough. Whether it's the madhouse or the Pentagon, there could be sanity on both sides of those lines. On the other hand, you know, in a period of political turmoil and struggle, you wind up making choices to be more or less on one side than the other. I picked a big argument in my life with science only because I found it to be big and bullying and self-righteous and smarmy and capable of doing great harm without recognizing it. And I think somebody's got to speak truth to that power. And so I've sought to do that in book after book. And this, I think, is the most humane and forceful statement I've made of that, because in this novel, I've tried to make Victor Frankenstein more than simply a mad doctor. He's also struggling to be a lover. He's struggling to do the right thing in life. I tried to tell the story as much as possible from his point of view. But I do finally come down on the side of Elizabeth, because Elizabeth both recognizes his genius and his greatness, but she also, as Mary Shelley did, said, but wait, there's a dark side. There's a dark side to what you're doing. And that is what Victor doesn't want to see, and that's what creates the monster. The monster is that dark side he cannot claim.
I'm speaking to Theodore Roszak, the author most recently of the memoirs of Elizabeth Frankenstein. The reason I bring this up is not so much to oppose you as to ask you a theoretical question. We're living in a culture now that's very much in need of balancing, of redressing a certain tendency. Perhaps we've always lived in this culture, and perhaps it's always the case that people of feeling don't have a choice. They must be on the side of the underdog, whoever the underdog turns out to be. That might very well be. I find myself wondering how one begins to address not the people who agree and remain inactive, but people who immediately say, oh yeah, all these guys, they want to bring back midwives. Mm-hmm. That's always the first answer, herbs. Mm-hmm. You know, and in, to some extent, after all, this radio show is an attempt to speak to the growing indifference to literature and imagination that's being perpetrated in the country. And I often feel, well, you know, I have no choice. Mm-hmm. You know, I can speak, of course, to the converted, but how does one speak? How does one make converts? Mm.
The approach I've taken in this novel is to try to keep all the characters as well-roundedly human as possible and try to understand within that situation where they go wrong. And I've tried to make it clear in Victor Frankenstein's case, and I think this is staying close to the original and perhaps close to life as the history of science has unfolded in our society. He's a brilliant young man. He's gifted with tremendous curiosity. He wants to know. And the paradigm he has given to develop that marvelous human quality is the scientific method. But that method, because it itself was shaped out of adversarial circumstances, struggling against obscurantist theology and churches and orthodoxies, had taken on a kind of harshness, a kind of pugnacity that made it not so much a pure joy, but a cause. And that's something we often don't recognize, scientists don't recognize, that modern science was born out of an adversarial relationship with the culture that birthed it. And it took on this quality of crusading for certain things over against other things. And that is so deeply embedded in the foundations of science that we don't recognize it anymore. There is a commitment, for example, on the part of many scientists to godlessness, because they fought, they had to fight their way out of a society dominated by theologians, privileged theologians and clergymen, established churches, established orthodoxies. And their solution to that was to throw out the baby with the bath, you know, not only to throw out not only to be anti-clerical, but to become anti-religious. They themselves have taken on that quality in their own history without realizing it.
It's funny, I thought you were going to say that the way one speaks to the people who are not already on one's side is by writing a thrilling and scary book that will sneak in. Because the memoirs of Elizabeth Frankenstein by my guest, Theodore Roszak, is an old-fashioned kind of scary book. Mm. And it does contain enough witchery and compulsion and sexual frenzy to stock several novels.
I hope that works too, actually. It's meant to be a good gothic thriller, if nothing else.
I wanted to begin, end by asking about the figure of the mother. Fathers have clearly failed in this book, but both in your essays and implicitly in this novel, you are speaking about a betrayal of Mother Earth and, in certain ways, a failure to recognize the wisdom of mothers in general. And I wondered if you could speak about that.
You know, Mary Shelley's own life was interesting in this respect. She was the daughter of a mother she never knew, but whom she came because her mother died giving birth to her, as many mothers did in that time. So she herself had an image of a heavy mother in her life. She tried to live up to that image. Oh, she really worshipped her mother. In this book, I've tried to capture something of that relationship in Lady Caroline and Elizabeth. Lady Caroline is not just her stepmother, but she's also her mentor, a kind of a guru. She's a woman in touch with old traditions and mysteries. So she it becomes the spiritual mother of this young woman, and then imposes upon her, I think rather ruthlessly, a project in life that is going to fail. But she nevertheless goes ahead with this, and then, of course, just barely lives long enough to regret what she has done. What I tried to capture in Lady Caroline is a sexually ambiguous, ambitious, gifted woman, and there were such women around in that period, who has begun to get away from the more traditional sentimental womanhood, motherhood, and move over into a masculine world where, in effect, as she says at one point, she has declared war against this terrible thing that's come into the world, the single vision of science. But in taking on that stance, that combative stance, she herself is driven to a kind of ruthlessness that finally destroys these two young people. So what I've tried to capture in her is the capacity of women, good women, and good mothers, to do the wrong thing, too.
I've been speaking to Theodore Roszak, the author most recently of the memoirs of Elizabeth Frankenstein, published by Random House. His earlier books, The Making of a Counterculture and The Cult of Information, have been reissued in paperback by the University of California Press. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica.
Too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Pop Time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.